listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2you.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. Also available on iTunes. And g'day to Chriso. Chriso. G'day, Chriso. Chriso said, excellent. Yoel and Jono, as another Aussie who is fascinated with the Torah, I thank you very much for these pearls. Thank you, Chriso. It's nice to hear from another Aussie. And Anthony, now Yoel, of course, we should tell everyone, we're doing Light of the Prophets. It's time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. Yoel, I'm going to read some of these really nice comments that were left on last week's episode. And this is from Anthony. He says, just had another great Hebrew lesson with Yoel. He's a pupil of yours.
Yes.
Nice guy. Yoel, seriously.
He actually sends me questions all the time on the stuff I put on the show.
He seems like a really nice guy. He says, Yoel, seriously, you're a major blessing. That's what he said. Keep doing what you do. May his genuine shalom be with you and your family. May he continue to meet all of your physical and spiritual needs. May he continue to lead you through his thoughts and ways. And Jono, g'day, mate, he says to me. That's pretty good. He's not an Aussie as well, is he?
No, he's an American.
Ah, there you go. Thank you for all your diligence in making this happen. I work 12-hour shifts at the shipyard. Oh, that's a bit of a tongue twister. 12-hour shifts at the shipyard.
He works very, very, very hard.
He does. My last shift, he says, I almost finished 12 sessions of Torah Pearls with Nehemiah and Keith. Such a blessing. To Jono and all his guests, may Yehovah, may our Father continue to reveal and lead each of you in his thoughts and ways. May he lead each of you in spirit and truth. Thank you for all that you guys do. Shalom. Thank you so much, Anthony. I love comments like that. It's really encouraging, my friend. Thank you very much. This is from Dan and Heidi. Dan and Heidi say, I love the straight talk, and I'm getting used to the different communication styles. I learn so much when I listen to you boys. Keep it up. And that's to you and I. Wherever you are around the world, thank you for listening. Obviously, time for the Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. And we are kicking off, finally, boy, when we thought we might have even done this in the first episode, Yoel, here we are in the third episode. We're finally getting to the part on the passage on Devorah.
Yes, Devorah. So, actually, I know quite a few people called Devorah. It's a very common name here in Israel.
It's a nice name.
The word Devorah actually means bee. A bee. Hmm. I have a sister-in-law called Devorah. My first kindergarten teacher was called Devorah.
Really? Hey, let me ask you. Let me ask a question. I'm glad you brought that up because it means bee, as in bzzz.
Yeah, bee honey. Honey bee. Sorry.
Is the root of the word related to devar, as in word?
I kind of doubt it. I don't think so. I think it's not related to the word devar. This you want to convey to the issue of the sound of the buzz. I doubt it. Hmm. This might be even a pure noun. So it stands by itself because the moment we can't find a verb similar to it, we have to treat it as a pure noun. And it really depends where the word comes from. So it's a very good question. It's a very good thing you brought that up because the issue of roots is though very elementary for people like me who grew up with Hebrew and everything, it's actually very, very confusing for a lot of people who don't speak Hebrew. So a very, very brief thing regarding roots. Hebrew words, and I'm talking about strictly Hebrew, have three consonants in a root, and we call them the radicals, and they represent the base where the word changes in different ways. Now, we have nouns and verbs, obviously, and it's been proven over and over and over again that there's three consonants in the root, and anything which is different is considered to be from a different language. Mm-hmm. And I keep on getting asked about this. I want to talk about it for a moment. There's this theory of that there's a thing called father roots and child roots and derivative roots. And I actually sat down when people started asking me about this. I actually sat down to read several articles about this subject. And the one thing that came out was when you say father root, son root, you're trying to say that there's a two consonant root and then it becomes three. It's not true. I actually sat down to look at the comparative works on different Semitic languages, and the one thing that was clearly defined there is that Semitic languages in general have a very clear rule that they have three consonants in a root, We have sometimes, if we have a word which is a derivative from another language, or a word that's been borrowed from another language, then we can have cases of two consonants, three consonants, sorry, four consonants, even five. There's even today we have a development of even five. But it's a relatively simple thing that, and understood by all linguists, that roots have three consonants and not more and not less.
So what is, just remind everyone what you mean by a pure noun. What is a pure noun?
A pure noun, okay, so one of the things is that they understand, some of the articles I read is that they understand that many words originally are related to some verb. And there's a discussion, what came first, the verb or the noun? Now, when you look at this world, this wasn't the world of Mesopotamia, this area, it was a world of actions, not philosophy. Mm-hmm. People weren't sitting meditating or something like that. People worked. People were moving around. So Hebrew is a very verbal, and most of my language are very verbal languages, mm-hmm. where the verbal system is way, 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 way more complex than, for example, English. English really has, I would say very simply, a very, very simple verbal system. But when you deal with Hebrew, the verbal system is very complex to a point where I can teach, for example, the nominal system. Nominal system had to do with nouns. Relatively quickly, but when it comes to the verbal system, even if you get the idea, there's a lot of patterns you have to memorize, a lot of ideas you have to understand, moods and meanings of verbs, such as, not just he walked. Mm-hmm. No, it can be he walked in a certain manner, and that would be expressed in the way the verb is used. So when we say a pure noun, we mean that a noun which is not has no relationship with a verb. Because a lot of nouns, if we look at them, we can find a verbal equivalent or something which shares the same root and mm-hmm. has a verbal meaning, and they have the same meaning.
Right.
And a pure noun is a noun that has no verbal counterpart. So the word devoir, for example, is probably a pure noun because it not necessarily has to do with the word devoir. If you want to say the word devoir, maybe. If we want to say it's related to the word devoir, which means words or usually in modern Hebrew they say it means things, but in biblical Hebrew it means words or mm-hmm. speech, then maybe the buzz of the noise, the buzz of the bee is what gave it its name.
Okay. All right. Okay. So that's interesting. Thank you for that. We better get into it because we're going to go from chapter 4, verse 1. We're going to try and get to chapter 6, verse 10. We'll see how we go. And it begins like this. When Ehud, who we read about last week, when he was dead.
Ehud.
Ehud.
No, Ehud. Ehud.
Because you know why I say that? Because it's got a big capital E and I just say Ehud.
But it's Ehud. It's Ehud. Ehud. And by the way, Ehud Barak, the Minister of Defense of Israel, has the same name.
Oh, there you go. Ehud Barak.
So it's a name even used until this very day.
Nice. And when he was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of Jehovah. So Jehovah sold them into the hand of Yabin. Is it Yavin or Yabin?
Well, it's spelt as Yavin. It's pronounced Yavin today. Yavin Melech Kenan, Yavin the king of Canaan. Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. What do you mean king of Canaan? Now, Canaanites were a whole bunch of groups of, you know, there were different nations living here. We pointed out this work quite a few times. So what does he mean he was the king of the Canaanites? And we can presume to say he was the king of the Phoenicians, because Phoenicians was basically a Greek form that meant Canaanites.
Oh, okay.
So, and if we notice, this battle, the whole story happens up north in Israel.
He reigned in Hazor. Where is Hazor?
Hazor. Hazor is probably in the Galilee.
Okay.
Let me actually open up a map. I'll try to give you an exact location. But Hazor should be in the Galilee.
So it's interesting. I didn't read this before, but in my study notes here, it says, Yabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Years earlier, Joshua defeated the king of Hazor named Jabin. Probably Jabin was a title rather than a proper name, resembling the use of the title Abimelech among the Philistines. We talked about that too at the time.
Yeah, we spoke about that as well.
Or Ben.
So Hazor, by the way, is actually north of the Sea of Galilee, according to some speculation. So it's in the area of the tribe of Naphtali, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Upper Galilee, really staying close towards the area of the Golan Heights.
Oh, okay. So it goes on to say, tell me what you think of this. It goes on to say, the name Yabin has been found in a text from Mari, in an archaeological
Mari, yeah.
Mari, on an archaeological site on the Euphrates River a system of small rival kingdoms prominent in Joshua's day, still prevailing during the period of the Judges, but Yavin was clearly more powerful than most. Hazor, having been destroyed earlier, had now been rebuilt. And now they make reference to Joshua 11:11 of when it was destroyed, and the site of Caesarea's headquarters. Now, tell me if I'm... Oh, my goodness, what's this? Haroshet
Hagoyim. Haroshet Hagoyim. Adam Zertal, who was the man who discovered the altar Mount Eval, actually did a survey in a place that he presumes is Haroshet Hagoyim, which happens to be in the Galilee, and he wrote a whole book called The Secret of Sisra, where he goes over the whole story of the discovery of the place. So it's very interesting. He takes archaeology and makes it actually interesting, because if you ever sit down and read an archaeological book, you'll fall asleep.
Right.
But it's very interesting. So he claims this was a city which was built very, very quickly in a style of building which has nothing to do with this region, has to do with more style of building that they discovered in Greek islands, which makes you wonder about who these people were. Mm. Why were they called Goyim, and why is it called Goyim? There's a whole bunch of things that have to do with the place. You actually have to read the whole book, and unfortunately it's not in English.
What does Haroshet? I assume that Hagoyim is the nations. Haroshet?
Haroshet. So Haroshet is from the word Chorsha. Haroshet becomes a construct chain. And Chorsha, it's very interesting. The word Chorsha is a place where the concept of a Chorsha is basically almost like an orchard, or a place where there's plants. And what's very interesting, the city he discovered is actually surrounded. The entire area is surrounded. It's very strange. The city sits in the middle of a huge open field with loads of trees in it.
Interesting.
Loads and loads of trees in it. Mm. So he said it's very interesting. They called it Haroshet Hagoyim, and it looks like some kind of like a natural orchard or natural tree area, but not trees. When you say an orchard, when you say Chorsha, you mean, it's on the tip of my tongue, the translation into English, but it's not a wood. It's not a forest area.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place where there's trees, but it doesn't, it's not as,
like an
as
oasis
crowded
or...
as a... No, it's just, it's almost like an orchard. It's like an area like where there's forest. Trees, but it's a miniature forest or a light forest.
Okay. Because it says the commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt there.
Sisera.
And the children of Israel cried out to Jehovah, for Yabin had 900 chariots of iron, for 20 years he had harshly oppressed the children of Israel. Okay, so that's the situation that they find themselves in. Interesting. Okay. But in any case, that's the situation they find themselves in. And verse 4 of chapter 4, now Deborah, a prophetess, I want to come back to that word, a prophetess of the wife of Lapidot. Is that correct?
The wife of Lapidot, yeah.
Was judging Israel at the time. Now, prophetess, if I remember correctly, Yoel, there are four or five women in the Tanakh that are referred to as a prophetess. One of them is Miriam, of course. We've already spoken about it. Huldah in 2 Kings 22:14 and Chronicles. Isaiah's wife, right? In Isaiah,
it says Vayikra v'leneviah, v'tar v'telet ben. So why is she referred as a neviah is a very good question, because we don't actually have any prophecies that we can give to in her name, but he refers to her as a prophetess.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting, and I'm glad that you said that, because we're going to be asking the questions: what are the prophecies of Deborah? We'll come to that. And another one I found was Noadiah. Have I pronounced that correctly? Noadiah. Now she's referred to, and it would appear that she was some kind of bad or false prophetess in Nehemiah 6:14.
I'm not too sure that's a woman.
Oh, really? Let's
give
go
me,
there.
G-
just
give me the reference a second.
Nehemiah.
By the way, I'm looking at the word Haroshet in its some context. And it's related to the word Harashu, which is in Akkadian, which means a mountain covered with trees.
Okay.
So it's not really a mountainy area, but there's a lot of trees there.
Nice.
So what about Nehemiah? Where?
Nehemiah 6:14, I do believe. I'm just going there now, and it says, "My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat According to that verse.
Noadiah. I was thinking about another. Noadiah, she's a prophetess. But we don't have anything really from her. They just basically, what was going on there is that they were hiring false prophets to go and so-called prophesize that they're going to do everything wrong. It's not going to work out. And at the same time, they had Haggai Zechariah and Malachi, and at the same time telling them, no, you go work. And actually, when you look at the book of Ezra, which, by the way, part of it's actually written in Aramaic. A lot of people don't know this, but in the original, it's actually most of it's written in Aramaic. And it says here in chapter 5, it says in Aramaic, with Nabi Haggai Neviyah, Zechariah, V'aidon Neviyah, Le'udayed, V'yurushlem, B'shem Elahai Yisrael Alehon. So it mentions here Haggai, Zechariah, and they both, it says, and Haggai and Zechariah prophesies, Haggai and the prophet, and Zechariah the son of Iddo, the prophets prophesies to the Judeans, or the Jews which are in Judea and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel, which is upon them. So at the same time, there was basically a whole battle there, battle of the prophets, we can call it, which was very, very normal. I mean, we find it with Elijah, with the false prophets of Baal. We find it with when Jehoshaphat or Yehoshaphat wants to they go to battle against the king of Aram. He and the king of Israel go to battle against the king of Aram, and there's 400 prophets there who tell him, you know, you're going to battle, you're going to win, and one of them even makes metal horns and says, like this, you will ram down the king of Aram. And the king Yehoshaphat says, you know, there's any prophet here of God. And they bring a man called Michael ben Yimla.
Ahab says, well, there's one, but he always says bad things about me, so I don't talk
exactly
to him.
And we have the same thing with Jeremiah. Jeremiah also has the same thing. Mm-hmm. That he goes around with a yoke on him, and they, you know, it's a battle of the prophets. Who's telling the truth? Mm. And it actually gives us kind of insight about the concept of prophecy, that people stood up and said they were prophets. And Jeremiah basically he turns around and he says to him, the prophet who will prophesy is good. If that good comes to pass, it's proven that he's a prophet. Mm-hmm. And it gives an interesting insight on the idea, because it once made me think that, why is he specifically saying good? Why isn't he saying just prophecy? Because when the state of war where they were in, and someone turns around and says, oh, it's all going to be okay, everything's going to be okay. And they're like, you look at it and say, are you, be realistic, it's not going to happen. Mm. But if this person turns around and says, in the name of God, and uses the name of God and says, such and such is going to happen, it's a good thing in such a situation, and it happens, like Isaiah, then we know he's a true prophet. But Jeremiah is telling you, it's like, it's easy to give people morale, but we know you're a true prophet only if it actually happens. And in our situation, if it happens, you're a true prophet. Mm. But he says to him, I am a prophet of God, and I'm telling you, this is going to turn really, really bad.
Yeah, very good point. So in this case, she is a prophetess, and she was judging Israel at the time. She was sitting under the palm tree of Devorah. She had her own palm tree. How's that?
She had her own place. Huh? She had to be known. Usually prophets sat in places that everyone knew who they were, except for Samuel, who went around all over the place. Mm-hmm. They all were more or less in the same areas. Huldah sat at a gate. She sits under the palm tree. Isaiah usually sat in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. You know, they most of them had a known place that they were at. That when people wanted to go and ask for God, there's a thing called Drishat Elohim. And they used to go to a prophet and ask a prophet. And the prophet usually sat in a known place that everyone knows where to go to speak with them. You don't have to start running around looking for them. They actually had an office.
They weren't elusive, right? That was her office. She's under the palm tree.
They had an office, exactly. She had a cool office with a good view.
Yeah, in the mountains of Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment.
If you've ever seen the mountains of Ephraim, wow.
I haven't.
It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
I hope to be there. Will I get to visit there in March, do you think, maybe? Let's see. Let's see how we go.
So, ladies and gentlemen, it's important, this thing. We want to bring Jono to Israel together with Keith Johnson. It's pretty expensive to do these things. Specifically, flying from Australia is very expensive. I thought once of flying to Australia, and then I realized how much it costs. I said, okay, I'm going to postpone that one.
Yeah.
It's very expensive, and we want Jono here. We're going to do special programs, which we will put on the radio station. We're already starting to work on the plans. So please donate to Jono. This is very, very important on different levels. So you go to the website, and there's a thingy there. You can What is it called? I keep forgetting. There's a thingy there.
It's a clicky. It's a clicky PayPal thingy.
It's a clicky thingy with Bob.
It's on the right-hand side of the of truth2you.org, and hopefully in March next year, if I get over there, we can do a program from the mountains Ephraim. I'd love to see that. And but the children of Israel would go there for her to ask her questions, and she would answer the questions, and she's a judge of Israel. And she sat and she sent and called for Barak, son of Abinoam. From
Barak, by the way, means lightning.
Boy, there you go. Barak,
so
lightning.
Let's ask a very simple question. Why is he called lightning? Think of the battle that happens here, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He literally crushed them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole discussion sometimes. I don't know if necessarily here, but there's always discussion of what, you know, he's called this and he's able to do something specific. And we have several characters like this. We have Noach, and it's derived from the word Yinachamenu.
Mm-hmm.
We have Ya'abetz, the Book of Chronicles. Ki imoy leto be'etzev Ya'abetz. Etzev, there's like a relationship between the names. And there's actually a discussion in the Talmud that says, you know, does the name cause something to happen? So was it that his father called him a name, and that name came into reality by calling him that? And I think people took names very, very seriously, but specifically in the ancient world, they believe that when you name something, you also give it its essence.
So,
it's a cultural thing.
Barack Obama, for example, is that the same Barack?
I think that name specifically is in Arabic or something, and I'm not an Arabic expert. It might be, I don't know.
So maybe it has a different meaning. That's interesting anyhow. But now she said to him, has not Yehovah God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor, take with you 10,000 men and the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun, and against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Yabin's army, with his chariots and the multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. And Barak said to her...
By the way, the Kishon is they had to work very hard to clean up the Kishon. It was really icky.
Oh, really?
When I was growing up in the Haifa area, the Kishon was pretty icky.
So it wasn't a place where you'd go and sort of cool your toes then?
No, you would not want to put your feet anywhere near even the mud in that area at the time. No, but it's been cleaned up. But notice something interesting here. Hmm. As I point out, for example, earlier on, you know, when we did the introduction to the Book of Judges, I point out the issue that at the time, these were not kings. So they only had authority over specific tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And notice she's only taking northern tribes here.
Yeah,
she's taken only northern tribes, and specifically tribes which are influenced or affected by the king of Chatzor.
Mm. And more than that, she's saying that God has specifically commanded just these tribes. You go and sort this out; it'll be fine.
Yeah,
delivered him into your hands. But now,
the song she criticizes other northern tribes for not getting involved.
She does. We're going to get to that. And so, verse 8. What do you got in verse 8? This is interesting.
Barak said to her, unto her, "If you will go with me, I will go, and if you will not go with me, I will not go."
What's that?
He's being chicken.
So she is just
to be very, very blunt, this is what he's doing. He's scared out of his mind.
but she said to him, as a recognized prophetess, right? She said to him, now this is what God commands. You go and do this. And she's a recognized prophetess. He should know at least well enough to say, okay, let's do it. But instead he goes, it's almost like he's hiding behind mummy's skirt. He says, if you come, then I'll know for sure that this is what God says. But if you don't go, I'm not going.
So I'm looking at another commentary here, and they're saying, no, he wasn't being afraid. It was normal to say to the prophet, go with us. I'm not too sure about that. No, usually when they want to ask, when they wanted to ask the opinion of a prophet, they just call over the prophet and say, what do you think? And we have that over and over again. We spoke about Mishael ben Imla. We have, there's a story with Elisha that they call him over, the war they had with down south with the Edomites.
Mm-hmm.
They call Elisha and he gives him prophecy, etc. But essentially, that's the way they did it. They never asked, okay, now we going with us. Here, he was already told, go and do it.
Well, she picks up on that and she says, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking. For Yehovah will...
Faith.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it seems. For Yehovah will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman.
And the Bible does not cut slack to anyone.
Hmm.
The Bible is here very bluntly saying he had lack of faith, and this is why he wasn't the one that the battle was finished by.
Wasn't credited to him.
Yeah.
Anyway. So then Deborah arose and she went with Barak to Kadesh, and Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and he went up with 10,000 men under his command, And Devorah went up with him. Now, Heber?
Hevel Hakini. So the question is Hever here a noun? Is it a verb? It's a very good question. But Hever Hakini can probably mean from the word Haver, the binding or the friendship of the group called the Keni, which were basically the name Kain. Keni is like you say, like saying English, American, you know, a generalization.
Oh, sure.
Keni,
yep.
Of Keni, or like saying the ish when you add to a name of a nation. And they were actually people from the house of Kain. Mm. And we actually have them. They're mentioned several times. One of the places they're mentioned in, which is kind of interesting, is the last prophecy Bilam gives about the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in Numbers 24, verse 21. It says, "And he saw the Keni, and he spoke his proverb, saying, strong is your seat, and put in the rock your nest. For if Kain will be eradicated, why would Ashur take you captive?" So they were hanging around in this area, in this region, and it actually mentions that they were the sons of Chovev, the in-law of Moses. So this was probably not Reuel or Jethro. This was another member of the family, and Chovev is mentioned as well in the Torah as being his relative. So they had a close relationship with the Israelites because the leader of the Israelites of a couple hundred years ago was their relative. So right, these are like distant cousins of ours.
I was going to ask you if we were talking about Yitro, but you're saying that that's not necessarily the case.
So there are opinions that say that Jethro, Yitro, had different names.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be that these were literally relatives. These were his sons, or these were, close relatives of Yitro.
Okay.
And, if we look at Yitro himself, if we go back into Exodus very, very quickly, so it says here in Jethro, the Choten of Moshe, and we have the word Choten here appear again. So Choten, usually they say, has to do with the parents of your wife. But when you look at it, it's, if it's Yitro, why is it mentioning someone else? So this is probably maybe Jethro's brother or whatever it would be.
Interesting. Very interesting. But so
to be very, very specific, the word Choten, as far as I remember, Choten always means a relative through marriage, because Choten Chatuna. Chatuna is wedding in Hebrew. Choten is a person who's related to you through marriage. But let me look at this very, very quickly in the dictionary, just to make sure that I'm saying something true here.
I'm just going to look at a cross reference while you do that, which is Numbers 10:29. Just see what that has.
Yeah. So the dictionary here actually wants to say very clearly that it has to do with the person, the father of the bride. But I remember very clearly. I saw several places where it says that maybe this was another name of Jethro. No.
Yeah. Okay. So now, did you mention Numbers 10:29 before? That's the one that says, "Now Moses said to Hohab or Hovab, the son of Reuel." Yeah. Okay.
So who's this Reuel person?
Moses' his father-in-law. Yeah.
Maybe Reuel. There's a whole bunch of stuff. There's different opinions, and this is why I keep on saying that probably the word Choten means someone that's related through marriage, and not necessarily the father of your wife, because it's very strange that it's using different names every time.
Very interesting. In any case, they do get it all together, and then in verse 14, Devorah says to Barak, "Up, for this day is the day in which Jehovah has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not Jehovah gone out before you?" So Barak went down to Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and Jehovah routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his family at the edge of the sword before Barak. So that's another example of just getting it over and done with in a verse.
Yeah, basically it's all done. It doesn't go into any details regarding this. He basically yells out to him, "Arise!" A battle cry. You think about the woman. A woman's giving the battle cry here.
Yeah, yeah.
So go. I don't know if people remember, we did a program about segregation of women in the Jewish world.
Oh, we did.
We see here very, very clearly, she's the one doing the battle cry.
Amen. Very good point.
From the Bible itself, women were treated as equals, specifically women with authority like Devorah. So it's kind of
so
interesting.
She's giving the battle cry to the king. The leader,
the judge, he's not a king.
He's up and he's off, and it's all over in the space of a verse. That part of history, but It says Yehovah. I'm in the next verse. No, Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. So he basically jumps out of the car and runs off down the street. And Barak pursued and chariots the army, but this guy gets away. He's obviously running for his life because it goes on to say that the whole army was destroyed. There was not a man left. They all perished by the sword. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Yael. Now, Yael, you said there is no relationship between Yoel and Yael.
Yeah, it's spelled differently. Yoel is spelled Yudvav Aleph Lamed. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the word Yudvav being an abbreviation of the name of God. I even found a source that claimed that it originally was Yehoel. I doubt that. But it has to do with the name of God. And then El means God. So basically saying God is God. Yael is the name of an animal. It's a wild goat or something like that.
Right, I see.
Or wild ram.
Okay. And the wife of Heber, the Kenite, for there was peace between.
I don't know if Eshet here actually means wife. It might be a woman who happens to be a wife in the family of Heber Akini. Okay. But it said you can say it's the wife of Heber. I'm looking at a commentary, it says you can say it's the wife of Heber, but it looks at the word Eshet Heber, it doesn't mean that she, it means a woman that belongs to the group called Heber.
Interesting. But in any case,
it shouldn't be translated as wife, it should be a member of this clan.
So they seem to be, maybe not necessarily allies, but there seems to be peace between them, and yeah. He approaches her and thinks, okay, so you're one of those, we're friends, I can trust you. She says to him, look, turn aside, my lord, and turn aside to me. Do not fear. And when he had turned aside into her tent, she covered him with a blanket. Now, he must be exhausted. I mean, he's been in battle all day. He escaped on foot. He's the only one to survive. He's been running for his life, and he's utterly exhausted. He finds a tent, and he thinks, I've got to crash here for the night. And then he said to her, please give
me. She's actually setting him up because she's covering him with a blanket. She has a plan here.
He feels kind of secure, I figure, because, I mean, you can't run forever. And he says, give me a little water for I'm thirsty. So she opened a jug of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. Milk? A jug of milk?
She gave him a glass of warm milk to make him fall asleep.
There it is.
It's a good thing she didn't give him any cookies as well.
But
she's setting him up. She covered him with a blanket. I mean, I don't know if people here have served in the military, but I remember when I was in the army, we used to go to a long times out in the field and stuff like that, running around. And it was very interesting that in the field itself, the moment you put a cover on a soldier,
mm-hmm.
bang, he's gone.
Mm-hmm. After a full day, they sleep well.
After a full day of doing that, think about it, this battle lasted, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours? Think of it that if you're active, very, very active, for 8, 9, 10 hours.
Oh, you're wrecked.
I noticed it was very, very interesting. As long as we were not covered, we were awake. The moment the warmth of the cover came in, we just we're out.
It's over. And particularly with milk. And it's not now, Yoel, in this particular translation, it just says milk. It says the same in the Song of Devorah in verse 20. Mayim
bikesh halav natana.
25. So what does that mean?
Because Mayim sha'al halav natana.
What's that?
No, that's the verse. Maim sha'al. Sha'al is to ask or to request.
Yeah.
Maim is water. Maim sha'al.
Mm-hmm.
Chalav is milk. Chalav natana. Or natana. I think it's natana. We actually had to learn these things into memory as children. We were tested. We had to memorize the Song of Devorah, and we had to memorize the Song of Hana, Samuel's mother.
Nice.
I had to memorize this one in fourth grade, I think, and then really? Hana's song in fifth grade or something like that. So there's bits of it still clinging in my head.
That's good. Well, listen, what I've got clinging in my head is that some translations say sour milk. Now,
You know something? I would not be surprised if it was.
Hmm.
For example, cultured milk, and mm-hmm. she has a jar of milk here. Hang on, I remember something very, very simple. In Hebrew, it says here, I hope we're not overanalyzing here, but it says nod ha-chalav, not kad chalav or anything. It's called a nod chalav. Now, nod chalav is a leather pouch. Now, if anyone has ever researched how you make kefir, they used to put it in a leather pouch and hang it next to the door, and each person who walked in would bang it and give it him, shake it around. Why is this a nod chalav? I mean, this is so it can be one of several things. It can be this was sour milk, and this is how they kept it.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that this was basically she just had a pouch with milk. No, they didn't have cups that time. These were nomads, as you can see. They were intense. This was just a way of giving him to drink without having to bring a cup and pour it from a jar and everything.
Without going to milk the goat, because of course they had no fridges, no refrigeration at the time, and so they kept things by torturing them.
Yeah, but if it would have been a clay, if she said, she opened up a clay jar and put it out, the clay would have kept cold, because all you have to do is dig in the ground inside the tent, put it into the ground, cover it with earth, and it keeps cold.
True.
That's how you preserve it. So it could be that this was cultured milk.
Yeah, quite possibly. Now we have talked, as you mentioned, the culture karite, people can find that on truthtoyou.org. We did talk about fermenting in the Torah, and you can find that there. But it says so she opened the milk, and she, as you say, she knows she's trying to put the goat. He's obviously exhausted. She's putting him to sleep so that he's out for what she has in mind for him. And he says to her before he crashes, he says, "Stand at the door." And this is all that he can muster. I find this interesting. This just goes to show how utterly exhausted he is, and how he just cannot go on anymore. He must stop here and recharge the batteries. He says to her, "Stand at the door of the tents, and if any man comes and inquires and says, 'Is there any man here?' say no." And that's all.
It says there is not. It says the word I, not the word lo.
No, okay. It says there is not. There is not a man. And that's going to have to do. He says to himself, I kind of imagine it this way, Yoel. I am so exhausted. I am about to fall asleep. I'm absolutely exhausted. There's no way around it. I can't keep going. All I can say is, if someone comes, just tell them I'm not here. There's no one home. And she goes, all right, no worries. But Yael, now she took it. Verse 21. Do you want to give us the details?
Okay. So, wow. She's a brave woman.
Mm.
So she takes. So it goes in. She took Yael. Eshet chever. It doesn't say akini. The yatad. Mm-hmm. That's like a peg,
mm-hmm.
a peg that they use to keep the tents up. This is for tents these size. This is probably pretty big.
Right. Now let me just get some detail on that, Yoel, because when we think of tents these days, we think of modern tents with the small, stainless steel pegs that you tap in with your little hammer, and it's all nice with the cord on there. But that's not what we're talking about here. What kind of tent peg are we talking about?
So these tents, if everyone's been in Israel and went to a Bedouin tent, that's more or less the idea. These were big tents which were built for housing to such an extent that, for example, a lot of the Arabs who live here in Israel, during the summer when they're out in the field with their herds, they actually build these tents, and these tents are houses.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a center pole, and it's a whole construction. There's a center pole, mm-hmm. and they're not beams, but they're the center, or maybe even something. There's two central poles and a beam in the middle, and then to keep everything tight, you have to pull it with ropes in a certain way, mm-hmm. and you put into the ground these big pegs to keep the tent up. Now, when I was in the army, we had tents like that as well. We had the small tents, the small tents when you sleep in the field. But we had big tents for us, and we had several central poles. And the tents themselves had to be the ropes were attached to the ground with these massive metal pegs that had to be literally. We had to take a 10-pound hammer to bang these things into the ground,
Like a sledgehammer, right? Yes. You've got to really slam them into the ground. And so this is a decent. I mean, obviously, this is something she can pick up, but it's a decent tent peg. And then she takes, what's the other thing she takes?
So she takes a makevet, which is basically another word for a hammer.
Okay. Now, before we go on, can I ask you a question about that word? And I think maybe we might have touched on this before. But
makevet, by the way, is usually it's more than a hammer. It's a bit heavier.
So is this related to the word Maccabee?
Yes. Yeah, so Judas Maccabeus, Yudah Maccabee, was called Yudah. For some reason in Israel, they misspell it as Maccabee. With a kaf, mem mm-hmm. kaf bet yud, and the book of Maccabees is spelled with a kuf, mem kuf bet yud, and it was called Judah the Hammer.
Yeah.
Because he used to, the way he battled, if you open up Josephus and Antiquities of the Jews and you read the battles, this guy was just, it was insane what this person was able to do.
And this
now, by the way, the word, these types of hammers were also, by the way, we could use them in war. These were mm-hmm. You could use them as a small a war hammer of sorts.
So the point is that it's heavier. This is a serious peg. This is a serious hammer. And if I remember correctly, I think this is maybe the only, if not maybe the one of two references to that particular word, the same word that is used in regards to Judah Maccabee.
It's actually a relatively rare word in the Bible. The word that's mostly common for hammer is patish.
Uh-huh.
It appears in several places. In Isaiah, I think it appears several times, if I remember.
Really?
Makeve fatish ve'olem pam, and then there's this place where it says v'chafatish fotzatzala. I think it appears more times in Isaiah than in other book, if I remember correctly.
So in any case, she's got this big pig. She's got the big hammer. What does she do, Yoel?
She slice and dice. she basically rams into his head to kill him. She puts it in a temple, which is a very, very soft place. I remember in school, I remember learning this in school, and my teacher's like, it's sat there and gave us, and she put it on his forehead and smacked it in, and then she stopped. She wouldn't go into the, but she basically, as my father would sometimes say, discombobulated it.
Yeah.
Made up for it, discombobulate.
From temple to temple, while he's lying asleep, absolutely exhausted, out to the world, she gets a tent peg, puts it to his temple, drives it through, probably out the other temple, and it says it went down into the ground, but he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. No kidding.
So the beds were actually on the floor. Mm-hmm. Sleep on an actual bed was very unusual. People didn't really have, unless they were rich, they wouldn't have, you know, nice beds like we do. We're considered to be a very rich culture. Mm. Anyone who lives in the Western world.
Sure.
And funny enough, yes, Israel is actually part of the Western world, but it's considered to be a relatively rich thing to find beds, so he was sleeping on the ground. These are nomads.
Mm.
So, you know, why carry around a bed? You just roll up to your mattress.
Yeah.
So when she banged it in, it basically went into the ground.
Straight into the ground.
And as you said, she ran it through from side to side.
She would have been moving the tent in, you know, after that, no doubt. And then as Barak pursued Sisera, Yael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I will show you the man whom you seek." And when he went in there into the tent, there he lay dead with a peg in his head through his temple. There you go.
Mm-hmm. Actually, by the way, I just saw the Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to say it means his jaw.
Oh,
why
really?
Would it be his jaw? Yeah, I don't understand that one.
Unless she went up,
No, but it went into the ground, so it had to be from up to down. I think that's the temple is a bit more.
I'm liking the temple. Anyway, so on that day, God subdued Yavin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel, and the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Yavin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed him as well. How about that? And now here we are in chapter 5, and the entirety of chapter 5. Yoel, take it away. Sing it to us, the song of Deborah.
Keep on dreaming. So a few things about songs in the Bible. There are very, very few sections which are called songs, which are called a song. We have the song in the sea. We have this. We have the song Ha'azinu in Deuteronomy 34. Mm. We have the song of David in Samuel 2. We have that song, by the way, repeated in the book of Psalms with a few variations, but more or less the same song. There's a very, very few places where we can say a song. And what's very interesting is the way songs are written in the Bible. And they're written in a very, very specific pattern. And the pattern here are lines with spaces in between them. So if anyone's ever opened up a Torah scroll, you can look at, for example, in Exodus, I think it's 15, mm-hmm. where you have the song in the sea, and it's sections upon sections upon sections, like short sentences or short verses or short paragraphs, literally one after the other, and they're usually written like that. So first of all, this division is very, very important to understand how the song is built, how the song is actually, it gives you the rhythm. If people remember, I posted something a while back about the Septuagint and things that claimed were forged in the biblical text by the Hebrew text. But as I mentioned, there's a thing about the rhythm or the tempo. You can see this rhythm inside these types of songs. You can see the way it pulses, which can give you also an idea of what speed this was sung at, maybe even a style of song. And it breaks up the song into the sections which were said. And it, for example, many songs were actually sung in groups, where, for example, one part of the group would say one half of the verse, and then the next half, the other part of the group would say the other half of the verse, or things like that. So, for example,
is kind of made up by that, right?
No, Song of Songs actually is not. The Song of Songs is actually more borderlines with poetry than an actual song. because actually a lot of books inside the writings are written like this as well. So mm-hmm. Psalms, Proverbs is written in a slightly similar pattern, though it's not a song. Job, most of Job is written in this style as well. Song of Songs. Song of Songs is written, yeah, like a regular text, which is very, very, very interesting.
So just
why is it called the Song of Songs and it's not in a pattern of a song?
The loveliest of songs. So what I'm wondering about while we're here, it says the Shulamite, and then it's sort of written in script form, and then the daughters of Jerusalem, and then the Shulamite and the daughters of Jerusalem, and it's kind of like there are parts for everybody that they sing. The daughters of Zion,
places,
the beloved.
The places where you can actually say this, these words are not supposed to be read out when the song is sung. It's supposed to be read by someone specific. We actually have several cases like this. For example, there are places on Psalm 72, I think it says, thus ended the song, the Psalms of David.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it actually in the actual text? So it's not supposed to be, really probably not supposed to be read out. A classic mm-hmm. word, and I know that's a bit of a dispute with people, but a classic word is the word Selah, not with an ayin, with a hey, samach lamed hey. And I remember I was with a tour group that came to Israel through Wisdom in Torah, Rico Cortez's mm-hmm. tours. And I remember I sat on the bus and I said, you know, who knows what the word Selah means? And everybody immediately said, oh, meditate. And that's what usually the usual lexicons explain. But as it was demonstrated by several Hebrew-speaking researchers, they think that the word Selah was a marker in the text to tell the singer to raise his voice.
Oh, really?
And there's different developments. This was actually the way it was taught to me many years ago when I was studying Bible. Yes, because in high schools, in religious high schools in Israel, you have to Bible study is one of the major things. And I did what's called 5 points, which is the highest you can do in a high school.
Uh-huh.
And we learned studying a biblical Hebrew to a certain extent. Again, it wasn't professional biblical Hebrew, but it gave us a very strong background in it. And I remember we were studying the Book of Psalms. And I remember the teacher said very clearly, you know, the different interpretations, but the interpretation that is the best one for this is the idea of being raising a voice. And it's interesting, that when you see the word Selah in certain places, it actually works with the way the text is built.
That's interesting, because I thought it meant consider, pause and consider, meditate, as you said, but that's an interesting interpretation.
I think that's the interpretation of the BDB. I think that's where it comes from.
So it says, we better hammer through this because we're running out of time. Then it says, Devorah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying, now there is some detail in here that is added, detail that we don't find in 4. You stop me when we find something interesting. It says, when leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give.
Which verse are you reading?
Chapter 5, verse 2. Chapter 5, 2, and then 3.
Hear, O leaders kings, lead?
That's what I've got.
You have leaders lead?
I've got when leaders lead.
It says, before Paraot be Israel bitnadev am barichu Adonai. Before Paraot, a Paraa is a riot.
What? What does it say when leaders
that,
riot?
That is a weird. That's what your translation says?
That's what it says.
Wow.
Oh, you
really?
Know what it says here? Oh, no. You know, it says something here in the study notes. I'll read it to you. The phrase, okay, when leaders lead, the phrase literally means, and don't you love it when they say that in the notes, it means, literally it means this. Well, why don't you put that in the text? It says, you know, why don't you say so in the first place? It says, it literally means the long-haired ones who let their hair hang loose.
That's pera se'ar rosho. So I'm actually looking at a commentary here. And they're saying that, yes, people were having serious, there's a very long note just on these two words, bra'ot. And he says, like, there's so many different opinions about what it means and everything. And I think to be very, very blunt, I think that the Rabbi David Akimchi was the one who got it right, which bra'ot means riots. When there were riots, were going on amongst Israel.
There's some complex stuff in poetic language, but I appreciate what you're saying, because it goes on to say.
By the way, this is considered one of the most difficult chapters in the Bible.
We're going to breeze over it. It says, but it does go on to say the precise meaning of this phrase is obscure, as you're pointing out. But it may mean that loosed locks or flowing hair were signs of great strength or leadership. People willingly offer themselves. Yada yada yada. Maybe it just says, you know, they let their hair down and just sort of chilled out.
No, but what it's basically saying here, at least the way I see that it should Pera is something which is wild. A riot is wild. So this is when, but there's a problem because then it says Bitnadev Am Baruch Adonai. Bitnadev is when they volunteered, when nation volunteered, volunteered to what? So I think the way to explain this verse is as follows. And again, as we pointed out here, there's a lot of different interpretations, but I'm going to offer interpretation here, which says when riots were going around where there was no order amongst the people of Israel, and then people volunteered to basically go out to war and settle things, all of you call out, blessed is the Lord.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, all right. So
that's the interpretation I wrote years ago, and I still stick to it.
Stick to that one. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I will sing to the Lord. I will sing praises to the Lord God of Israel. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water. I love
This is probably talking about, she's probably talking about the revelation of Mount Sinai, and she's not the only one who does this. It's mentioned in several other places. There's a Psalm, I think it's Psalm 78, no, 68, I think, does it as well. I think, don't catch me on the word. Don't catch me on my words, but I think Psalm 68 or 69.
It's beautiful language, this poetic form is beautiful. And it goes on to say, the mountains gushed before the Lord.
Yeah, it's 68.
Psalm 68.
It says here, God, when you walked in front of your people, when you marched in the Shimon, which is a desert, Selah, the word Selah appears, the earth trembled, even the heavens dripped because of you, God. That is Sinai before you, God, the God of Israel. So have this concept. So there's actually a researcher called Knoll who happens to be the uncle of a friend of mine, and he goes around claiming that, you know, this is a battle song of the original wars of Israel, and he came to this whole conclusion that the Israelites were Canaanites and everything. And he tried to read his book, and I had a bit of a giggle in the middle of a bookstore when I was reading that. But it's interesting; they always keep on repeating in several songs, which is usually war songs, the fact that God appeared on Mount Sinai in a terrible form, with fire blazing and the earth shook and everything, because it's the most potent memory amongst Israel when it comes to revelation of God and the power of God. This is probably why it's used here.
Very good point. We see it again in Psalm 90:10. Speaking of the Psalms, Yehovah reigns, let the earth rejoice, let the multitudes of isles be glad. Clouds and darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. A fire goes out before him and burns up his enemies all around. Lightning lights the world, and the earth sees and trembles. The mountains melt like wax at the presence of Yehovah. At the presence of Yehovah, the whole earth, the heavens declare his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. And it goes on in like that in a similar way. And in verse 5 of chapter 5 here in Judges, the mountains gushed before Yehovah, this Sinai before Yehovah, God of Israel, in the days of Shamgar. Now, we talked about Shamgar last time.
By the way, the language here in verse 5, Zesinai Penei Adonai Elohei Israel, is extremely similar to it's almost word to word the verse we have there in Psalm 68.
Yes. Okay? True. Beautiful.
It doesn't use the name. It uses Pnei Elohim instead of the actual name.
Right.
It's kind of interesting.
In the days of, now, this is the only other verse in the Bible that refers to Shamgar, the other being at the end of chapter 3, verse 31. After him was Shamgar, the son of Anat, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad. He also delivered Israel. What a guy. And in the
so
days of
Yael. So it's interesting here. It says, in the days of Shamgar, the son of Anat, in the days of Yael, chadlu ochot. So orach is usually roads. There's derech and orach in the Bible. And she's basically saying the trouble of the riots and the mess in the land was already around the times of Shamgar. So she's going back to the judge, which literally was the judge before them. And she's basically pointing out, already at the times of Shamgar, way before we came, there was already problems and people stopped walking around the streets. So she's actually saying, she's probably saying it got worse and worse, and each time they had a need for a different judge, it was even worse. So they had this and they had that, and then at times of Shamgar, people couldn't even travel on the roads.
Couldn't even travel on the roads. They walked along the byways, it says here, and village life ceased, and it ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, until a mother in Israel. They chose new gods. Then there was a war in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people. Bless the Lord, she said.
So bless the Lord is repeated. It's the very second time we see the word bless the Lord.
True.
And this is almost like...
like the end of the chorus.
Yeah, the end of a chorus, exactly. It's like a chorus. Baruch Adonai, like, hallelujah, or whatever you want to compare it to.
Nice. Speak, you who ride on white donkeys, okay, who sit in judges' attire. I've got speak. What do you got?
No, it just says riders of white donkeys.
Really? I've got it. That's weird. I've got speak, you who ride on white donkeys, who sit.
Oh, yeah. The verb speak here is in Hebrew, it's at the end of the verse. When you translate English, you have to put it at the beginning. Okay.
What is that? Safar or what is it?
Sihu.
Okay.
Sihu is not speak. It's have a conversation. The sicha is a conversation. So sihu is mean talk with one another.
And you
so she's maybe hinting to the idea of like, you ain't talking to one another, this is a problem. This is probably what she's hinting to. And when you read on, you'll see the problems they had in between tribes. Now, they say the tribes were in covenant with one another. Well, no, they were not. They presumably were, but people were running away when they had to.
Yeah. So verse 11, far from the noise of the archers among the watering places there they shall recount the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villages in Israel. Then the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates. Awake, awake, Devorah, awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam. Then the survivors came down, the people against the nobles. The Lord came down for me against the mighty from Ephraim. Those were whose roots were in Amalek. After you, Benjamin, with your people, from Machir, is that right, Machir?
Machir,
rulers came down.
This is interesting. Why is Amalek mentioned here? And is she saying a curse unto them? Or is she saying something else? The language, I mean, really, I remember, every time I go back to this chapter, it's like, what on earth is going on? Because when you look at the Hebrew, it's pretty tricky to understand what's going on here. I was wondering about why, because Mini...
Also this 15, 14 and 15, yeah.
It's a very strange verse.
From Ephraim.
They say here, what is their root in Amalek? Their Mini is like the word mean, which is similar to the word kind or from. And from Ephraim, their root in Amalek. Is she cursing them because they didn't get involved in the battle? And what's going on here?
And from Zebulun.
Or she's saying, your ancestors who were led by Joshua, who happened to be from the tribe of Ephraim, led a battle against the Amalekites, which were a fearsome enemy, and they won the battle, and here you're not getting involved in this war. And it's very complex what's going on. And after you, Benjamin and your people, Machir is the son of Menashe, Yardu Mechokekim, Zvulun Moshchim Beshevet Sofer, and from Zebulun, the people who write with quill.
You can write with the quill?
Shevet Sofer, Moshchim, to Mimshoch is to, probably to write.
Okay, so let me tell you what I've got. I've got, and Zebulun, those who bear the recruiter's staff.
Shevet Sofer, maybe it's a recruiter's staff. I mean, again, Shevet is usually a staff. Sofer is a counter, so maybe they're standing there and counting people. It's strange. It's very strange because the Sofer, the position of a Sofer in the king's court was basically a minister of sorts. So
speaking of king's courts, I mean, verse 15, what I've got in verse 15, and the princes of Issachar were with Devorah. Is that what you have?
Yeah, more or less.
Princes of Issachar?
Or Sarei, which means, usually people translate it as princes, but Sarim is from the word Sarara, which is rulers. So princes can work.
The princes of Issachar were with Devorah. As Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley under his command among the divisions of Reuben. There were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds? This is where she gets into it. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings of the flocks? The divisions of Reuven have great searchings of heart. Gilead stayed beyond Jordan. And why did Dan remain on ships? Is that what you've got? He remains on ships?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So Yagul can be from to live. It can also be from the word Yagal, which is to fear. So they feared and ran away on ships. Oh, so this is sometimes what happens with poetic language, is that they can use a certain word and it can have several meanings, which causes trouble.
Sure. And they could mean both of them. Ashair continued at the seashore and stayed in his inlet. So she's saying, you know, you guys sort of just chilled out. You didn't get involved. You didn't want to get involved. You were scared. Zebulun is a people who jeopardized their lives to the point of death. Naphtali also on the heights of the battlefield. So she talks these guys up for getting involved. The kings came and fought, and then the kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. And they took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens, the stars, for their courses, fought against Sisera.
So this refers to the, it says Vayahom, where is it? There's a verse that says, Vayahom Adonai Sisera. So basically, Yahom is to, from the Hamam, to shock someone. So the battle shocked the warriors of Sisera, and now she's saying wasn't just the moment God decided to attack them, then the entire universe went into the attack.
This is quite
common, I think, if I remember correctly, when they talk about God, if he goes a full fledged attack against someone, so the forces of nature are involved as well.
And so then it talks in verse 21 about the torrent of the Kishon. Is the Kishon really a torrent these days?
What it says here, it says Nachal Kishon Gerafam, so I don't know what you mean torrent.
I've got the torrent of Kishon swept them away, that ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. Oh, my soul, march on in strength.
It uses the word Nachal, and the word Nachal just means a stream or a little river or something.
Really?
Why would they translate it as a torrent? Because torrent, usually torrent in the Bible is, there's a different word for it.
Interesting. Okay. And so then the horse's hoofs pounded, the galloping on his steed. Curse Meroz. Who's Meroz? Now, this is interesting. Verse 23. Take us through verse 23.
Meroz might be a place. Oh, Meroz. So,
but she's quoting a messenger of Yehovah, right? Where did this come from? Is it speaking of Devorah?
So Oh, some people say Oh is from the word Arar, to curse. Pursuit of the people of Meroz. But it's really, I mean, again, this is a complex verse. So they say Meroz, the people, Meroz is the name of a place, and there's an angel or messenger of God who's cursing them because they didn't join the battle. So because it says Oru Meroz Amam Olach Adonai Oru Aror Yoshevah. So Oru has to be from the word curse, because then we have Oru Aror again. Aror is very clearly from the root of Arar, which means to curse. So it curses the people of Meroz. Why the specific people of Meroz is not very clear. What exactly was this place called Meroz? Very, very strange to me, never identified, but it uses the word Arar, the root of Arar, three times, which is emphatic. It's like really, really, you know, cursing them, really, really cursing them.
And it says, because they did not come to help, to the help of Yehovah, to help Yehovah against his mighty. So they curse whoever it is, they curse him. But it's interesting that they evoke, or they quote, rather, a messenger, or what I've got in my translation is an angel of the Lord, a messenger of God. It's interesting. Where did this come from? When did this messenger speak? And so, it just sort of inserts it into the song.
Some people say that this was Devorah herself. She's the angel of God, so she's the one who's cursing them.
Perhaps.
Some people say that.
Okay, so that
but then opposing to that, she says a blessing to Yael.
And there it is.
Deliberately here, they're basically opposing. Meroz probably was maybe a city of Israel, didn't go. And then this lady, this one woman from the house of Hever Akeni, goes and does a battle in the name of God, the God of Israel. So she's basically really, really turning them off.
And so we're right at the beginning in chapter 4, verse 8. No, sorry. That's right. We're 8. Where Barak says, "If you go, then I'll go. But if you're not going, I'm staying here." And she says, "Surely I will go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking. For Jehovah will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." And here we see the glory going to Yael, as you point out, verse 24. Most blessed among women is Yael, the wife of Hever the Kenite. Blessed is she among women in tents. He asked for water. She gave milk. She brought out cream in a lordy bowl. A lordy bowl is what I've got.
Lordy bowl.
Lordy bowl. And stretched her hand out to the tent peg, in her right hand the workman's hammer. Sounds like something heavy. And she pounded Sisera. She pierced his head. Now, just curiously, Yoel, what is the word used for hammer in verse 26? Is it different?
Actually, doesn't really say the word hammer. It says, V'imina lehalemot amelim. So it's not talking about the word hammer as a noun. It's more using a verbal description of the action itself, of using something heavy to pound it. So halam is to pound. Amelim is from the word amel, which means difficulty or hard labor. So it's something that's the hard labor to pound it with.
There's actually a lot of emphasis put into the action that she takes here, because it says the workman's hammer.
It's bravery. It's brave. She was very, very brave. So it's emphasized. She did something that usually men were the ones who were able to do such things.
And so it says she pounded Sisera, she pierced his head, she split and struck through his temple. And Yoel, the image that comes to my mind is that it wasn't done in just one clean swoop of the hammer, but there was a number of poundings going on to drive it home into the ground.
I don't know about that.
I'd like to read it like that. At her feet, he sank. He fell. He lay still, you reckon? And at her feet, he sank. He fell. Where he sank, he fell dead. There's a bit more emphasis in. There's no doubt about it. It's good night for Sisera in verse 27.
The word nafal, by the way, the word drop here, is repeated three times in each section. Ben raglea kara nafal shachav, ben raglea kara nafal, ba'asher kara sham nafal shadud. The word kara and the word nafal is repeated three times.
That's interesting. Nafal.
Kara is to fall over, to kneel, usually from kara, from kara'im, which is the thighs. So going down on your thighs, like for example, people when they go to martial arts, they sit like that for a while. And nafal is to fall.
To fall, which reminds me of Bereshit chapter 6. It talks about the Nephilim, the fallen ones, right? The fallen.
Well, the Nephilim not necessarily means that they were fallen. It's a bit complex to explain that one. But some people say they're called Nephilim because they called other people to fall over when they were walking.
Very interesting. I've never heard that before. We'll pick that up again sometime later. The mother of Sisera looked through the window, did she? And cried out through the lattice, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarries the clatter of his chariots?" Her wisest ladies answer her, "Yes," she answered herself, "Are they not finding and dividing the spoil to every man a girl or two? For Sisera plundered of dyed garments, plunder of garments embroidered and dyed, two pieces of dyed embroidery for the neck of the looter." What does that all mean? What's that about?
It actually says here, "For they will find, or surely they will find," and they're basically saying, "Oh, don't worry, he's fine." They're probably just looting, and it uses the word racham rachmatayim, which is kind of funny. So it's referring to womb or two wombs in a sexual meaning.
Really?
And she basically saying, "No, they're basically having their spoils of war." This is why he's late. Reason. Don't worry about it.
That's why he's late. I see what you're saying. All right. I think we're going to finish it up with the end of the last verse, the end of Judges chapter 5. We're going to pick up from chapter 6 next week. But do you want to give us the last verse, verse 31?
Like this, Ken, Yovedu Korovecha Adonai, like this, all your enemies will perish, Adonai. Mm-hmm. And his beloved ones will exit like the sun in its glory.
Beautiful.
You know, if you've seen a sunrise, everyone knows it looks nice.
Yeah.
And then it says, incorporated in the actual part of the song, it says, "And the land became quiet for 40 years.
So is that actually part of the song?
It actually appears as part of the song.
Really? I didn't know that. So the way that it's written in my translation.
It's not part of the song, but in the text itself, it's incorporated into the formula of the song.
Interesting. So the land had rest for 40 years.
And the rest of these, yeah.
Okay, we're going to find out.
Sheket is actually quiet to silence, and not necessarily rest, but it actually means rest.
Okay, so a little bit of peace. So there it is. After Devorah, that's obviously possibly the highlight of her career, at least as far as the Tanakh is concerned, a judge of Israel. We're going to be picking up from chapter 6 next week, and that is the story of who?
It will be the long story of Gideon.
Oh my goodness, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to get through.
Yerubal.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to be able to get through all of that. Well, let's see how we go next week. Gideon, judge of Israel. It's an awesome story, another awesome story, and I can't wait to get to it. We've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo. This is Light of the Prophets on Truth to You, truthnumber2letteru.org. Thank you, Yoel, for being back on the program. And just a reminder to all the listeners that his Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. There is a link on the sidebar of truthtoyou.org. On the right-hand side, you can go there, click on it, it'll take you straight to it. And you can like the page and get involved there. Also, now I know, Yoel, you are booked up at the moment, but, you know, people can get on the waiting list and the email for Hebrew lessons, if you so desire, from Yoel ben Shlomo, the Levite in the land, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, dear listeners, you can also show your support by donating at truthtoyou.org. That's truth2u.org. Next week, Gideon. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Well, call to you're enjoying the violence, aren't you?
Come on, what is not to enjoy? Go on, the goriness of pounding a giant tent peg with a huge hammer, a workman's hammer through the skull.
Oh, man.
Through the brain, into the ground. Seriously, you've been moving tents after that. That's not the kind of mess you can clean up.
Yeah.